are in Psalm 62, waiting on God is what I've titled the message here. You know, it's amazing to me how many psalms are written about, you ready for this? People problems. If it wasn't for people, we wouldn't have any problems, would we? that's not entirely true, but, and it's like D.L. Moody said, I've had more problems with myself than any other person, right? I'm a people, right? Anyway, it is amazing. I mean, it caused David to write a lot of psalms, people problems. We got another situation like that in Psalm 62. It's another psalm of David, and he was dealing with treason. But the exact occasion is not spelled out. Tradition suggested it might have been the situation with the rebellion of his son Absalom, but that, again, is not certain. The superscription reads, to the chief musician, to Jeduthun, a psalm of David. The chief musician is thought by some to refer to the Lord himself, the chief musician. In that case, David would be dedicating the psalm to the Lord, but more probably it is addressed to the leader of choirs in the time of David. Jeduthun is thought to perhaps be another name for Ethan, which is also found in the titles of Psalm 39 and 77. He was one of the musicians appointed by David in his day to lead Israel in worship. Note on the overhead basic outline, waiting on God, verses 1 and 2, waiting upon God, verses 3 and 4, confronting treasonous adversaries, and then verses 5 through 8, trusting in God alone, 9 and 10, what to not trust in, and 11 and 12, power and mercy belong to God. One of the things I do appreciate about David in the Psalms is it really, you know, because we all do have situations with people, whatever you're going through, it's going to be people problems. I'm just telling you, it's coming. If you live in the world, in the real world, and you're interacting with people, there's going to be some people problems. And sometimes people are not going to treat you very good. And so it's good to kind of study, you know, how did David handle this? What did he do having a real people problem where somebody's trying to take him down? Knife him in the back. How'd he handle it? That's good. Now, that's where we are. Verse 1, truly my soul silently waits for God. From him comes my salvation. The word truly here can also be translated as only or alone. For example, the ESV translates it this way. For God alone my soul waits in silence. From him comes my salvation. Literally, it reads, only to God is my soul silence. So that's the idea. Some form of the word only or alone is found four times in the first six verses. This theme of waiting on God alone is prominent in this psalm. In fact, the NIV Study Bible says, no psalm surpasses it in its expression of simple trust in God. Where is your trust? Well, David is emphasizing, it's in God, God alone. The picture is of a soul in repose, waiting on God for deliverance. You know, sometimes you think, well, you know, God's going to deal with you, and I'm going to be the instrument. Well, that's not the spirit here. He's waiting on God to work here. So he begins this psalm by declaring that he's resting in God in the face of treasonous threats. Verse 2, he only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be greatly moved. So again, only, note the word only there. David emphasized that God only was his rock, his salvation, his defense. His rock pictures a place of unshakable security. His salvation, his deliverance. His defense means his fortress, a place of protection. He finds all of these realities in God. Bible Knowledge Commentary says, as warriors used to feel at ease in an impregnable fortress, so David rested in the Lord. That was his safe place. This was his safe place. Well, because of who God was to him, David affirmed that he would not be greatly moved. He's very confident of this. But now he turns and addresses his adversaries. Verse 3, how long will you attack a man? You shall be slain, all of you. Well, that's pretty clear. What are you really thinking, David? Like a leaning wall and a tottering fence. So here David addresses his adversaries, as I say, and the sense is they just won't let it go. When he says, how long will you attack a man? It's like they just keep coming. They're not going to let up on this. And he said, okay, you want to quit? You're going to die doing this. David sees their day coming when they will all be killed. You shall be slain, all of you. David has no doubt they're going down. He's quietly waiting upon God, but he believes that God's going to intervene to their detriment. And he says it in a very strong way. Now, the last part of this verse, when it talks about like a leaning wall and a tottering fence, that's a little bit debated in terms of how that should be understood. Either David was saying his adversaries thought he was weak and vulnerable, like a leaning wall and a tottering fence, or that he was saying they were actually in that position, even though they were attacking him. So I tend to think David is reflecting what his adversaries were saying about him. And the reason I tend to think this is because of what it goes on to say in context in verse 4. Notice what he says, verse 4. They only consult to cast him down from his high position. They delight in lies. They bless with their mouth, but they curse inwardly. Selah. In their conversation, it seems that all they can talk about is their plans to bring David down from his position, from his high position, which was really the throne. I mean, that's where David was as King David. He was in a high position, the highest position. He was on the throne. And it seems that there was some conspiracy to overthrow him. That's where we get this idea that there's a conspiracy in view here. Pretty much everybody agrees that that's what we're talking about. The exact occasion and what's all involved is not clear, but it does seem that they're wanting to bring him down from his high position. And this is why some think the revolt of Absalom may well be in view. And perhaps it is, but we are not certain. But it is interesting how Absalom worked, you know, behind the scenes. People would bring want to bring their case to the king, and Absalom would pull and say, if I was the king, I would give you justice. I'm your man. And he's stealing the hearts of the people. Say, yeah, but David, he won't help you. And so David's getting a bad rap in that respect. So, but whatever the exact scenario, and again, we don't know, people were blessing David with their mouth, but inwardly they were cursing him. They were total hypocrites. They were two-faced, and David, in effect, saw right through them. William MacDonald says, while pretending loyalty, they were plotting treachery, which is always a very dicey situation. Verse 5, my soul, wait silently for God alone. Comes back to this. After, you know, he's not happy with these guys, and he says, you know, you're all going to die. But then he comes back to, my soul waits silently for God alone. For my expectation is from him. I'm looking to God to intervene here. I'm looking for God to deal with you guys. Even though he mentions his treacherous adversaries and their two-faced evil ways, his major focus in this psalm is really on God. He does mention them, but then he really, for the most part, focuses on God going forward. David has learned that he needs to wait silently upon God, and he kind of gives himself a talking to that end here. Notice, my soul, wait silently for God alone. He's talking to himself here. You know, it's a place for some self-talk. And, you know, lots of times I've talked to people and said, yeah, I was getting out of line over here, and I had to sit myself down and give myself a good talking to. David's kind of doing that right here. Notice in verse 1, David resolves to wait silently on God alone, but in verse 5, he tells himself to stay the course, in effect, and renews his mind with the fact that his expectation or his hope is from God. Again, sometimes we need to talk to ourselves. There's a place for that. We need to remind ourselves that our focus must remain on God and the reason why. Where is our expectation? Expectation here is the idea of expectant faith. I'm expecting God to intervene. I'm expecting God to work. It's depending and waiting upon God for deliverance. Someone has well said that silently waiting on God is the antidote to despair. And I think that's a good thought. Now, where do you go? You go to the Lord. David did. Verse 6, he comes back to this again and again. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be moved. This is almost an exact duplication of verse 2. The only difference is that in verse 2, he said, I shall not be greatly moved. Whereas here in verse 6, he says, I shall not be moved at all. It's like the more he focuses upon God, the more assured he is that in God he is secure and safe. Warren Wiersbe says, the greater the realization that God was his fortress, the greater the calmness in his heart. Verse 7, in God is my salvation and my glory, the rock of my strength, and my refuge is in God. You know, he kind of keeps repeating the same theme again and again and again. This is his focus, who God is to him. And note how personalized David is in his view of God. My rock, my salvation, my defense, my salvation, my glory, my strength, my refuge. Very, very personal all the way through here. Well, with resolve to trust in God alone, David now exhorts those who are with him, in effect, to trust in God also. Notice what he says, verse 8. Great memory verse, by the way. Love this verse. Verse 8, trust in him at all times, you people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. Selah. The time is always right to trust in the Lord. Trust in him at all times, you people. All times. I don't care what you're going through. Doesn't matter how bad things look or how much this conspiracy is and how evil the connivers are. What should we do? Trust in him. Trust in him at all times. This is no time to do anything else. Trust in him at all times, you people. And then he says, pour out your heart before him. Pour out before your heart before him. David practiced this, and so should we as God's people. Many times we just need to pour it all out before God. We need a session like that. Our sorrows, our fears, our doubts, whatever we're going through, the turmoil in our soul, we need to work it out, pour it out to God. And I think trusting in God and pouring out our heart to him, they go together. You know, we have that wonderful little verse in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 7, which says, casting all your care upon him. Why do you do that? For he cares for you. Casting all your care. Bring it to God. Take it to God. That's what David is saying. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. That's our safe place. That's where we go. Tell God. And God's the one who can really do something about the situation. David Gazik says, he welcomes the poured out heart as the cities of refuge welcome the hunted man in ancient Israel. That's a neat thought. The emphasis in this psalm is quietly waiting on God in faith, but at the same time pouring out our hearts to him. It's not always easy to wait silently, certainly not for people of action, which I kind of tend to be one. But we like to do something about the situation. But sometimes we just need to quietly wait upon God. Warren Wiersbe said, God's delays are not God's denials, but our impatience can be used by the devil to lead us on dangerous, destructive tours. Sometimes you just need to sit, wait on God. But note it carefully. Silently waiting on God does not mean we are not praying. We can silently wait because we are pouring out our hearts to God in prayer. And I think they go together. This is the secret to silently waiting. We're pouring out our hearts to God. We're looking to God to deal with the situation instead of scurrying about in the flesh to try to deal with it. So silently waiting and pouring out our hearts really go together. And then he says, Selah. It indicates a pause, probably a meditative pause. Stop and think about this. Am I resolved to quietly wait on God in faith? Am I resolved to leave this with God? Have I poured it out and given it to him in that sense? Do I properly recognize who God is to me in this situation? And have I prayed about this earnestly, pouring out my heart to God? Selah, stop and think through these things. Think as David was reiterating what's going on in his heart and his soul. Selah, verse 9, surely men of low degree are a vapor. Men of high degree are a lie. If they are weighed on the scales, they are altogether lighter than vapor. You know, vapor is not a heavy thing. It's really not. When's the last time you put vapor on your scale? Remember, the theme of this psalm is trusting in God alone. We are not to trust in people. Strong emphasis here. After telling us to pour out our hearts to God and that God is a refuge for us, a safe place, David strongly refutes the idea that people of any status are worthy of our trust. People of low degree are common people. David says they're a vapor, meaning they're insignificant. They're not worthy of our trust. On the other hand, men of high degree are a lie. There is no security there either. Because of their high position, one might be tempted to trust in them, but he says it's deceptive. In the end, they are not worthy of our trust either. If weighed on the scales, to see the weight of their worth, as it were, they are altogether lighter than vapor. That is, they amount to nothing. Their help is worthless. They represent no substance worthy of trust. Pretty strong statement. You know, mankind tends to boast in himself and his resources, tends to want to put stock in other people. This has always been the challenge for Israel. Instead of depending on God to protect them, they look to the Gentiles, which they were not to do. In the day of the Lord, God is going to put down every lofty thing that he alone might be exalted in that day. After emphasizing this strongly in Isaiah 2, the chapter ends on this note. I always think this is such an interesting verse. Again, that's the context of Isaiah chapter 2, the day of the Lord, when every exalted thing is put down. The Lord alone is exalted in that day. And then he says at the end of the chapter, "Sever yourselves from such a man whose breath is in his nostrils, for of what account is he? Air breathers are of no account in terms of deserving our trust." Don't put your stock in man, is what he's saying. We have a great contrast in Jeremiah between the one who trusts in man and the one who's trusting in God. Jeremiah 17, 5 and 6, "Thus says the Lord, cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength, whose heart departs from the Lord. He shall be like a shrub in the desert, shall not see when good comes, but shall inhabit the parched places in the wilderness in a salt land which is not inhabited. Cursed is the man who trusts in man." And then, in contrast, he goes right on to say this. Verses 7 and 8, "Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord." Doesn't seem to me you can have it both ways. You say, well, some of my trust in the Lord and some of it's in man. Boy, he's really making a dichotomy here. It's one way or the other. "Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord and whose hope is the Lord, for he shall be like a tree planted by the waters, which spreads out its root by the river and will not fear when heat comes, but its leaf will be green and will not be anxious in the year of drought, nor will cease from yielding fruit." Now, what do you think is the tendency of the human heart? He's just spelled this out. The issue is trusting in man, trusting in God. You know what the next verse is, right? Jeremiah 17, 9. "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked." The tendency is to not trust in God, but to put our stock in man. And so you want to be in the blessed side of the equation, trusting in the Lord. In the end, there are only two ways you can go. You can either trust in man and his resources, or you can trust in God. Well, David's really making the issue here. We need to have our trust in God, relying on him alone. Remember the alone emphasis? Back here, verse 1, "My God alone," I should say, "in God alone my soul waits in silence. He only is my rock and my salvation." Verse 5, "My soul wait patiently for God alone." Verse 6, "He only is my rock and my salvation." Boy, the point is made. Verse 10, "Do not trust in oppression, nor vainly hope in robbery. If riches increase, do not set your heart on them." Now, David here seems to draw a contrast with his enemies who did these very things. The exhortation is really to not adopt their way of thinking, their philosophy of life. Don't trust in oppression like these wicked people are doing. These people who want to overthrow me. Some people think the way to get ahead is through oppression. That's David's enemies. They trust in their abusive ways to get ahead. That is the way of the wicked. Don't do that. Don't trust in oppression. Nor vainly hope in robbery. Others seek to rip people off, take advantage of them through robbery, taking what is not theirs to have, thinking that will get them ahead. And he says, if riches increase, I think even legitimately, don't set your heart on them. In other words, don't put your trust in riches. Now, some think that very possibly Paul in 1 Timothy 6 may have been alluding to this very verse. Here's what it says there. 1 Timothy 6:17. Command those that are rich, and that means there will be some of us that are rich. Command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, don't be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. You know, David became a very wealthy man. There is nothing inherently wrong with riches, but the exhortation is to not trust in them. It's easy to start saying, well, I'm going to let my money kind of take care of me. No, 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 don't get that mentality. Again, David Gazik says, it is possible to hold great wealth without trusting those riches, but it isn't easy. He says there are at least three ways in which one may set the heart on riches. Number one, to take excessive pleasure in riches, making them the source of joy for life. Number two, to place one's hope and security in riches. And number three, to grow proud and arrogant because of riches. Well, we don't want that to define us for sure. Well, David exhorts God's people not to trust in oppression, robbery, or money. These are all worldly things that people look to in an effort to make themselves secure. But there's no safe place or salvation in any of these things. Verse 11, God has spoken once, twice I have heard this. The power belongs to God. Okay, I'm in a situation where I'm very vulnerable. Where's the power source that's going to take care of me? It's God. God has spoken once, twice I have heard this. It's really a poetical way in the Hebrew of making the emphasis of certainty. It's similar to when Jesus said, truly, truly. It states something as a surety with a dogmatic emphasis. And what David heard God say with absolute certainty is the power belongs to whom? To God. That's why he says all the other things about God, his safety and his salvation, his fortress, his defense, all these things. Power belongs to God. That's the secure place. To trust in the resources of mankind is folly because power belongs to God alone. He alone, therefore, is worthy of our trust. He alone can ultimately do something about perilous people problems, treacherous people who have no real value system that's honorable. It's because power belongs to God that David was so determined to trust in God alone. I mean, if power belongs to God alone, then it makes sense that's where our trust should be. Well, David refused to look anywhere else for his strength. Verse 12, also to you, O Lord, belongs mercy, for you render to each one according to his work. There is a twin truth that goes along with power here. Not only does power belong to God, but so does mercy. Mercy is the Hebrew word hesed, that rich Hebrew word hesed. It is a combination of faithful and loving. And for this reason, it is often translated as loving kindness. Others translate it as loyal love, steadfast love, faithful love, unfailing love. You get the idea. It's often associated with God's covenant faithfulness. It's in the context of his covenant commitment. Not only is God alone powerful, he is also totally faithful. And that's a beautiful combination, power and faithful. And in the end, God can be totally counted on to right everything. At the end of the day, he's going to totally right everything. That's God. In the end, everyone will get exactly what they have coming according to their work. You know, there's comfort in that if you're on the right side of God. Now, this is true of believers in terms of rewards, and it's true of unbelievers in terms of punishment. Everyone's going to get what they have coming. Everyone. No exception. It's what he says. For you render to each one according to his work. Each one according to his work. By the way, if you do a study of judgment, you will find that all God's final judgments are based on works. Works. Our works ultimately tell on our life, whether it be a life of faith or a life of unbelief. For the believers, we see, like here, the believer's judgment, relate, and we're talking about rewards. Our sin was taken care of at the cross. That's been settled. I often say to my wife, I'm going on the grace plan. I know myself too well. I'm going on the grace plan. That's the only way I'm getting there. But there is an evaluation in terms of our stewardship. 2 Corinthians 5:10, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. This is the believer's judgment. That each one may receive the things done in the body. That's what's being evaluated. What do you do in your body? Your body's an instrument, a stewardship. What are you doing in the body? According to what he has done, whether good or bad. Depending on that, you're going to receive a reward or suffer a loss of reward. Whatever the situation is, it will be rendered out to each one according to his work. And then also for the unbeliever. We have the unbeliever's judgment in the book of Revelation. Revelation 20. I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged according to their works by the things which were written in the books. God's got the books on everybody. The sea gave up the dead who were in it. Death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them, and they were judged, each one personally, individually, according to his works. ESV Study Bible, a person's work shows whether his faith is real or counterfeit, and God will sort out who is who. This is therefore a ground of confidence for the believer and a warning for the unfaithful. Warren Wiersbe, no matter what people may say about us or do to us, God keeps the books, and one day will give sinners and saints the rewards they deserve. Indeed, he will. You render to each one according to his work. The book of Ecclesiastes is the most philosophical book we have in the Bible as Solomon tries to make sense of this life. And here's where he ends up. Here's, in his mind, the conclusion of the whole matter. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. There is going to be an evaluation for all of us believers in terms of rewards. There's going to be a judgment of the unbeliever's works and a corresponding punishment. Well, to wrap it up here tonight, security is found in God alone. That's the emphasis of this psalm. Power belongs to God alone. Unfailing love belongs to God alone. So what should we do? How about this? Trust in God alone. That's what David resolved to do. That's a good place to put your trust. Trust in God alone. Power belongs to him. And also hesed, his unfailing love. All right, let's stand and have our closing song, and then I'll close in prayer.